As Virginia said, my name is Daryl Brunch. I'll be talking actually more about ROPS and RPC today, since there's a little bit more to it. I believe the last presentation about RPC was pretty comprehensive. So a brief agenda for today. First, I'll just kind of go over some of the layout of the documents, some of the, I guess, a little bit of history behind it, why we put what information we did, especially with ROPS versus the handling versus RPC, etc. Next, I'll just go over two examples, just kind of step through the active parsing, active execution, and active serialization of the fonts afterwards. Then a couple topics after that. Just reiterate the fact that parsing cannot be stateless. Give an example to why this is important. Finally, talk a little bit about server objects, a little bit of properties of them, how some of them, while they may be named the same, actually do act differently. And finally, just one random topic afterwards related to this. So when we started doing documentation for this, we had to kind of decide how to arrange this stuff. We had all these ROPs which we need to document, and we had their behavior, and we also had the wire layout. So we kind of went back and forth. One extreme would be to pretty much put everything in one document, the behavior and the wire layout. The other extreme would be to just split it up completely into separate documents. So something like Ox PRPT would contain, or C PRPT would contain both the wire layouts and the behavior of the ROPs. So both of them kind of seem to be a little bit extreme. So we went for something between, where we put all the wire layouts and a lot of the stuff that's related mainly to parsing into this one document. And that was able to keep us down to like a reasonable size. And also, it allowed us to kind of denote that as a layer itself. What happens is there has to be some dependency between the ROPs. For example, if there's multiple ROPs in a buffer, you have to pretty much know how to parse the earlier ROPs before you parse any later ROPs. So because of that, the MSOX ROPS document covers layout of the wire, any general parsing concerns such as buffer too small, all the server object handle table work, and a couple of ROPs that don't seem to fit elsewhere, such as, I guess, release, and I think backbone. So what doesn't the document cover? So the document really doesn't cover the behavior of any of the ROPs. So to know what it means when you get the certain ROP, or what server should do in response to it, is covered in documents. Some of the common data structures, such as properties that are used in multiple places in multiple documents, such as fast transfer, ended up in OXY data. And then finally, fast transfer had its own documents. So, as I said, the thought behind separation was we didn't really want one humongous document containing everything. On the other hand, we don't really want to split it up too much, so we ended up with something. Is any questions about that at all? And on to the first example. So for this example, what I'm doing is I'm pretty much taking the input buffer that comes in to the RPC ext2, just taking the entire one and kind of just stepping through it at this point. So this is pretty much one of the, this is just an example of what I got from testing on a test box where just connected Outlook. So this is the first one. In this case, it's just a log on. So let's just look at the first header here. And what I did was pretty much just grayed out everything except for the region I'm looking at. And all the underlines mean is just every alternate one. It's the way I separated out the fields. So in this case, we see that first row bytes, the version number, always 0. Next one is the flags. In this case, we have flags indicating that payload here has the XOR magic applied to it, and this is the last of the packets. Finally, we have the size and size actual being the actual length of the rest of it. In this case, it's not compressed or anything, so they are equal. So now that we know this part, the first thing we have to really do is unapply the XOR magic to the second section. So once we do that, we have something that looks a bit more like a actual ROP list. So now let's actually start going through here. In this case, we have first 4 bytes being the size, second block being the list of ROPs. In this case, there's only one of them, and finally followed by the server object handle table. Now, As for the ROP size, you could actually either look at it as a size where it includes the size of the ROP size field and the ROPs list, or you could also think of it as just an offset to where the server object handle starts. So they're both pretty much the same in that way. So now that we have the sizes taken care of, we can start looking at the actual ROP list itself. So read the first byte, it's FE, ends up being ROP log R. So at that point, you know exactly what's coming afterwards. So in this case, we just have the login ID requested by the client being 0, followed by the output handle index being 0, and login length being 1. So interesting thing is, ROP logon is the first ROP. It's kind of a bootstrapping ROP. It is the only, ROP request that doesn't require an input handle at all. So it's the way we have to end up getting started with a communication with the server. The next section is just the next four fields of logon. So you have the open flags all listed here. You have the store state. You have the DN size followed by the DN itself. So this is just the distinguished name of the administrator account I was using. And that pretty much takes us to the end of the input buffer. And all we have left is the server object handle table, which just contains one value. So since the value wasn't known by the client at first, the client just puts in null value, and that tends to be these negative one here, all Fs. Now that we pretty much have parsed through the request, we can start looking at the response. So let's say the server wants to respond to this. We have same ROP ID for the response. Handle index is the same as the request. Return value success, and followed by the fields here. And here's the second set of fields. Regular GUIDs, REPL ID, and REPL GUID. The logon time, or time listed there, I didn't break them out. If you want, you can always go to find out what time I actually did run this. The store state here is 0, and the handle we're returning for this logon object is also 0. So for this example, what I'll be doing is just kind of constructing the list from the inside, or the response buffer from the inside. So at that point, we're just going to start with writing prop ID, and appending everything afterwards. In this case, output handle, return value, logon flags is right here. After that, we have the set of 13 folder IDs that come afterwards. Response flags, GUID, REPL ID, and REPL GUID. Followed by the last three fields, we have logon time, port time, start date. So they just keep appending onto each other.
Those folder IDs is just like the IDs of folders, new folders below this long box.
There's a set of ones like root folder, inbox folder, hangout box. It depends on whether it's a private or public one.
So there are known sets of folders that sit under.
Yeah, I think the documents should describe which ones exactly are there.
The IDs are unique, like across all the users, and you have
No, they're only unique for mailbox. So, yeah, so you could, if you logged in with another user, I think, especially in Exchange 2010, you'd probably get very similar ideas. So the scope of them is for mailbox. So now that we've finished with the ROPs list, we can now start putting prepend the ROP size to the beginning here and attach the handle table to the end. So the handle table here is the resulting handle table, which is just all zeros in this case. I don't remember the details offhand. I think the only store state is whether the search folder is supported or not. And I don't know if it makes much sense. I don't know if it's really ever passed the server as anything besides 0. I think it's pretty much returned back the same way. I don't know. I guess I could look that up and get back to you about that. But my recollection is that's the case there. So now, as soon as we get the ROPs list done, we need to append the RPC header for the beginning. In this case, it's pretty much the same as what the client sent for the flags as the last one. We're going to apply the XOR magic next after this. And at this point, we apply the XOR. So the interesting thing is with this buffer is there's a lot of zeros in it because a lot of the IDs had zeros in it. You can easily see what the XOR pattern is here. All the A5s. So this is pretty much the summary of what the response and the RGB out in this case will look like. So the next example I have is one that comes later on. I noticed the interesting thing about it was that they had two ROPs for the buffer. So it's I'm going to go over how they kind of relate and how pipeline works. So in this case, since the RPC header isn't as interesting, I skip that. I'm just going to go over the ROP into the buffer and ROP out the buffer. So looking at the input buffer, what we have is we have the size at the beginning. In the ROPs list, we have two different ROPs encoded. And finally, we have the server object handle table at the end. So the server object handle table contains two entries. The first one is pretty much the logon that we got in the previous buffer. And we have an uninitialized value in the second position. The two ROPs themselves are open folder and bit property specific. So in this case, folder's open and the client is asking for properties off of it. So just looking at the, so this is the creation of the output buffer. So in this example, I did it slightly differently. I mean, the server is can pretty much put this stuff together any way it wants. In this case, I'm pretty much building a valid buffer every time. So I'm starting off with pretty much a default buffer, which is a size of 2, which indicates that there's no ROPs list afterwards, followed by the same server object handle table that was passed in by the client. So in this case, let's actually execute, or let's first parse the open folder. And these are pretty much the values we got from it. And at this point, we want to actually execute it. And we get this response. So the interesting thing here is we have an actual output handle index, an output handle in this case, which we're going to insert in the place where the output handle index specifies. So pretty much the serve object handle table changes after we execute this first ROP. And sure enough, when we put the response in the buffer, the ROPs list extends a little bit, and we have an updated server object handle table. So the server object handle table is the interesting part, because now we start executing the ROP get property specific request. The input handle for the get prop specific contains the output or the open folder. So at this point, the input handle index resolves to the handle table, so we get the handle 1 instead of the handle uninitialized. And the rest of the values are just get property specific values here. And the output in this case is input handle index just remains the same as the request. This return value is 0, so it is a success. And we just return IPF note. So I believe this was the inbox folder, so that's why IPF note gets returned from the inner class. So now we can insert the second ROP response. And notice that the ROP size does increase and the server object handle table stays the same as what happened after the first ROP. So this is just a quick example of how the pipelining works, how you can have multiple ROPs that work on the same object. You can actually open, do operations, and even release the same object in a request, at which point the client wouldn't even see the handle at all. You could also reuse indexes too. So in this case, you see that for an output index, the value that was in the server handle table was pretty much this uninitialized value. I mean, there's nothing in the protocol that stops you from using other values. I don't think I've ever really seen Outlook do it, but I think there's nothing preventing you from seeing that. So these are the two examples. I decided to move on from this and talk about a little bit about, or just reiterate the fact that parsers cannot be stateless with this protocol. So as I mentioned in the previous presentation, there's a couple of bits of state that the parser needs to keep track of to successfully parse a buffer. So first you have the column from the table, because certain ROPs like query rows contain pretty much a untagged list of property values. So the parser would not know where one property ends and another one starts, unless it keeps track of the column from the table. Same thing with request properties. If you're parsing the response of a get property specific, you pretty much have to keep track of what properties were requested in the actual request buffer. The last two recipient row columns, This isn't the case of open message or reload message. You get a list of columns, same sort of thing. You have this property row structure that is contained in response of read recipients, or when they come back in those two or three different blocks. And finally, we have public or private logon. This is important for, I think, set, reflag. One of them changes its pretty much its structure based on whether it's public or private. So as an example of why this is interesting, I constructed this buffer here and pretty much didn't have any state before. So if you look at this buffer, there's a couple different ways you can actually parse it sort of thing. So first one I have listed here, we have the prop ID starting from query rows, we have the standard prop stuff afterwards, and we get to the property row. In this case, I'm just assuming that we have two properties. First property is a string 8, and the second property is an int 32. So as you see, this takes us to the end of the buffer. So as I said, this was only one possible way of doing it. Another possible way is, let's say, instead of having two properties or two properties in this table, we only have one, and the type is integer 64. So in this case, we end up parsing the first part the same. We have a different property, and now this is the end of the one prop. So we keep reading, and we end up having another buffer afterwards. So this is a pretty much contrived example. I didn't really see this ever in practice. More likely that you'll see something where you can have a query rows followed by like a notification. However, it's one of those things where I think this only comes into play if you happen to have something where you start listening to a communication halfway in between and you don't have any context. So on to server objects. Now this is just the list of server objects that could be returned by props. We have pretty much the basic ones. Logon is the first one. We have the folder, the tables that come from views of folders, messages, attachments. We have messages, attachment streams, and then some of the other basic ones are fast transfer, the synchronization ICS ones, followed by the notifications.
Okay.
Yeah, actually, at the end I'll talk a little bit more about that ownership. I didn't have a slide for it, like, add some information on it. So in general, not all logons are the same. As mentioned before, we have private and public. We affect kind of the what props are valid for these logons. So we have certain props, such as ghosted folders or is ghosted, that only makes sense for public folders. Not all tables are the same, so we have five different tables. We have the hierarchy, we have the contents table, and we have attachment table. They're kind of one group. And then we have the permissions and the rules table afterwards. So in that, they're different is certain operations work on one of them, such as restriction, where I don't believe they're implemented for rules and permissions. On the other hand, we also have a kind of a difference in how the contents of the table are modified. So for messages, attachments, and folders, you have these separate ROPs for creating them. In the case of rules and permissions, you have modify table, which actually goes through and modifies a row at a time. And finally, we have the fact that not all objects that sort properties are the same. So we have ROP, get property specific, we have those types of operations which work on several different server objects. So we have logon, we have folders, we have messages, attachments, etc. So the point I'm trying to make here is the visibility of it. So you can think of it as maybe as transactions, for example. So if you have a folder open, or if you have two server objects open on the same folder, if you call set properties on one of them and then get properties on the second one, what happens is the second one will immediately see the changes made on the first one. So this is a case for both logons and folders. On the other hand, you have attachments and messages. What happens here is the transaction pretty much stays alive until the end, or until the save changes for these objects. So in the case of having the same message open two different times, making changes to one of them, like set properties, will not be visible to the second one until you call like save change. And then the second one will probably get some sort of error, such as object modified, if anything happens during the save. Now, the reason I brought this up is because it's kind of interesting for the first other topic here. So stream locks. So you may have noticed that there's two props here, the prop lock region stream and prop unlock. So one point I had to actually kind of figure out what exactly this was doing. Looking through the history, it looks like this was added back for Microsoft Schedule Plus. And as far as I could tell, it wasn't actually used anymore, but it is visible through the map interface because it is visible off the iStream interface that you get for the streams. So as I mentioned here, you had a stream open for a message or attachment. If you ever locked that using this, it really wouldn't make any sense because you can't lock yourself out of it, and no other server object really contains the same view of this stream. So, or I guess for messages and attachments, this pretty much is no op.
So, what was it used for? Application of both same object handler from multiple threads?
I mean, that'd be my guess. I mean, I didn't find the source code for Schedule Plus, so I wasn't able to figure out what it did. I mean, the only place where it didn't seem to be valid was in folders. So logons don't have any properties that are long enough to really make sense streaming. So I believe there was a stream on one of the calendar folders that Schedule Plus used. So the other thing I noticed while looking at how this was implemented was there's an expiration of 30 seconds. So what would happen is if you locked the region, waited 30 seconds, any operation on that stream at that point would return you an error. It ended up being some network error. And the only operation that actually was supported on that stream at that point was pretty much you had to, I guess, unlock the entire thing to be able to recover. So that and the fact that the behavior is you can unlock any other lock in the stream. So if you have two server objects, you lock the region with one, you can easily unlock with the second one. So this leads to an interesting recovery scenario. Because you have a situation where, let's say, you have two server objects open and a lock expired. So by default, you think, well, the way to recover from it is, as soon as I get this error, what I'll do is unlock everything and then just lock the region I care about again. The difficulty comes if you have two of them, kind of a race condition between two of them. Let's say both are detected at the same time. One of them starts to go through the process of unlocking and relocking sections at once. So then you contact switch to the other one, which just noticed that, hey, I got the same error. Let me do the same thing. Let me unlock and lock the region one. So in this case, the second one just ended up unlocking what the first one just locked. So yeah, at this point.
Do you think it's a good idea to just remove those swaps?
Well, as you say, that's kind of what decision we made in 2010. Like, well, we didn't think this is used anymore. It had some weird semantics. And my guess is with Schedule Plus is maybe this was based on UI, so you never really had a situation where two of them were competing. Maybe the user was only looking at one view of it at a time. But I guess that's my guess. The other possible explanation could be maybe when the application got this error, it just closed everything down and reconnected. Yes?
Why not implemented? Do you mean that this returns video support, or do you mean that it's just a no-op?
I think we implemented in 2010 by returning not implemented. The error code got it.
And no one complained?
No one's complained yet.
They're Asians.
No. So, of course, this is one of those things where you may find out that we're wrong and have to implement it. But right now, it's safe. Yes?
Did you just start mentioning the cloud saving?
Yes.
So, does that say that
we have to lock? For the save in this case? So, the save is there's two ROPs, ROP save, message. Save changes message, and save changes attachment. Yeah. One of the ways. So those two props are the ones that I was going to say. So this is pretty much the end of my slides. I did mention the fact that I didn't include a slide for dependencies. So the reason dependencies were documented is because I noticed 2007 had this interesting behavior where it kind of saw this dependency between things. So I believe one of the cases where if you had a stream on a, for example, a folder property, what would happen is if you close a folder, the server would say, okay, he's done with the stream too, and just close it underneath you. So the problems with this is, of course, the server is now able to reuse the handle value, and if the client doesn't close things in the right order, you get in a state where the client could see two different objects with the same handle value. Now this is the only problem for, I think, 2007 and earlier. 2010 doesn't have this, so this is the main reason why it was documented as this dependencies between these objects, just so the client knows which order to pretty much, I guess, release objects without getting itself in trouble. yes. Does that answer my question?
Okay. Also, from our implementation, like there's a minute in the middle, we maintain all the objects, so we don't know where to release object in this view or object tree can go. Client server close the objects, but you keep the object like that when you use.
Yeah.
There will change for not using the same handle, solving some problems.
Yeah, that's the other thing. I think if you ever look at the behavior of 2007 and 2010, the handle values returned are, you can tell that the scheme is different. 2007 and earlier intended to reuse it more. Like it intended to stay down with the lower end. Whereas 2010, you'll see, it just keeps going higher and higher. The only time you'll actually get the same range again is when you loop around. So, unless you have a very busy client, that should take a little bit. I think this pretty much sums up the stuff I have. I guess, is there any other questions about props or anything in that area? Okay, Jason, thank you.